What happens when the institutions of liberal democracy are under assault and half a nation commits to believing a lie? That's the question that looms over a new biography of Alfred Dreyfus, the man at the centre of the Dreyfus Affair that consumed the attention of France and eventually much of the world in the late 19th and early 20th century. Dreyfus was a French military officer from a Jewish family who was falsely accused of spying for the Germans in a climate of intense anti-Semitism. His plight became whatever the French call a cause célèbre, with novelist Émile Zola publishing his famous J'accuse open letter in support of Dreyfus. Evidence that Dreyfus was framed eventually emerged and he was ultimately exonerated. Maurice Samuels is a professor of French and director of the Yale Program for the Study of Anti-Semitism. And he's the author of a new book called Alfred Dreyfus, The Man at the Centre of the Affair. Maurice, welcome to RN.
Thank you. Very nice to be here.
Maurice, why write a book about a subject which has been amply covered in the past? Why write a biography of Alfred Dreyfus now?
Well, the Dreyfus Affair is unfortunately extremely topical right now. I think we're living in a period of rising anti-Semitism around the world. And the Dreyfus Affair, which is one of the most famous cases of anti-Semitism, I think helps us to understand our current moment by putting it into a longer historical perspective.
Were you able to access new and original material in researching this book?
Yeah, so the subject of the Dreyfus Affair is one of the most written about events in French history, with the exception of the French Revolution. I think it's the most written about event. So it's hard to say anything new about the Dreyfus Affair, but I did try. And really in two ways. So first of all, the Dreyfus family had left a huge collection of their private family archive to the Jewish Museum, the Maj, in Paris. So I was able to work with that collection, which was really great. And they have, for instance, just like one example of something I found there, they have various Jewish ritual objects that were saved, that belonged to Alfred Dreyfus and to his wife, and that were saved by the family. And those are in that collection. So that helped me make the case about what Jewishness meant to Dreyfus and his family. And then the other thing that I think I tried to do that was new in the book, besides having just sort of a new take on the Dreyfus Affair, but no one had ever really done a comparative look at how Jewish communities around the world viewed the affair. So I read various Jewish newspapers in English, French, German, Hebrew, Yiddish. I had some research assistants helping me. And so that was also a new research contribution.
Could you give us a little outline of the background of Alfred Dreyfus and what his initial rise within the French military entailed?
Yeah, so he was born to a wealthy Jewish family in Alsace, which is on the eastern edge of France. His hometown, Mulhouse, was invaded and occupied by the Prussian army during the Franco-Prussian War in 1870, and this was a kind of trauma for Dreyfus as a 12-year-old boy. And that was one of the things that led him to become an ardent French patriot. The family opted for French nationality when the newly unified Germany claimed Alsace and Lorraine. And that really determined his decision to devote his life to defending France and to becoming an army officer. So he went to the École Polytechnique, which was then, as now, one of the best schools in France. And he went to officer training school. And by 1894, he had secured a kind of coveted position on the army's general staff. And I should say that at the time, there were many Jewish officers in the French army, something like 300 Jewish officers. But he was the only Jewish officer on the army's general staff. And that's one of the reasons that when the army discovered there was a traitor in its midst, someone was trying to sell secrets to Germany, they immediately suspected him.
Yes, and perhaps you could also give us an overview of exactly what happened when that allegation was put forward, because it is a truly horrific and heartbreaking story, but one that Alfred Dreyfus managed amazingly to survive.
Yeah, so they accused him of being a traitor. It was the worst thing he could imagine. They didn't even share what evidence they had against him with him or his lawyers. So he faced this very unfair 3-day court-martial. He was found guilty and sentenced to life imprisonment on Devil's Island, which was this horrible penal colony off the coast of French Guiana on a tiny island surrounded by shark-infested waters. He was the only prisoner. He was kept in a rudimentary hut, guarded day and night with a light shining on him all night so he couldn't sleep. At one point, they started chaining him to the bed so he couldn't even move when bugs were crawling all over him in this tropical climate. The food was inedible. It was really, really brutal conditions. And it's amazing that he survived for 5 years. And so I try to argue in the book that often people kind of dismiss him as, you know, first of all, having not really participated in the fight for his own freedom because he was on Devil's Island while his family and all these other French intellectuals fought to free him. But I try to show in the book that if it hadn't been for his incredible fortitude, then the Dreyfus Affair never would have happened. If he had just succumbed as he wanted to do, and I quote many instances in his letters and in his diary where he says, you know, I would just give up if it weren't so important to me for the sake of my family and for the sake of France to clear my name. So he clearly understood what was at stake, and that gave him the strength to carry on under those horrible conditions.
And I was surprised to find in your book there's one mention of Australia, because although he was eventually imprisoned in Devil's Island, he was almost imprisoned at Duco Island near Australia.
Yeah, exactly. And that's where the French sent were sending most political prisoners, also to New Caledonia. But they, in his case, they decided to send him to Devil's Island, that they had decided to stop sending political prisoners there, but they made an exception in his case. And the conditions were so bad that Victor Hugo, the writer, referred to it as the dry guillotine, because it was just expected that he would probably die.
We're speaking with Morris Samuels about his new book, Alfred Dreyfus, The Man at the Center of the Affair. And Morris, you've described your book not just as a biography, but as writing a Jewish life of Alfred Dreyfus. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so the book is published in a really great series from Yale University Press called Jewish Lives, which are short, readable biographies of famous Jewish figures in history from biblical times up until the present day, including, like, you know, Barbara Streisand and, you know, various Jewish celebrities. So it's part of that series. And I decided to take that brief seriously and really think about what it would mean to write a Jewish life of Dreyfus. And so for me, that meant three main things. It meant first thinking about what Jewishness meant in Dreyfus's life and for his family. And there I kind of go against most historians or many historians who say he was just an assimilated Jew. And I try to say, no, in fact, Jewishness was much more significant for his family. They were integrated Jews, but they weren't assimilated in the sense of giving up their Jewish identity.
And this really buys into a big historical argument, doesn't it? Because you quote Hannah Arendt describing Dreyfus's identity as a sort of form of Jewish anti-Semitism. And yet, in contrast, you describe the role of Judaism in the life of Alfred Dreyfus and his family as discreet but important. Perhaps you could unpack that a little bit more.
Yeah, exactly. So I think Arendt is really unfair. I think she looks at him and says, oh, he was an army officer. This is part of Jews who were losing their Jewish identity. And, you know, this is part of her larger critique of assimilated Jews. And she's, you know, writing this in relation to Nazism, I think, later. And so she's looking back at this period and kind of blaming French Jews. And she takes Dreyfus as typical of that. I actually show in the book that it's really not the case. So he wasn't a personally religious person. He was a rationalist and a scientist, but his wife was religious. They were married in the Grand Synagogue of Paris by the chief rabbi of France. Everyone in their family married other Jews, and Jewishness was certainly very important for them. It was not seen as a zero-sum game with Frenchness. So for them, becoming fully French did not mean giving up their Jewishness. They thought that the two could go hand in hand because the France that they wanted to be part of was the France of the French Revolution that had emancipated the Jews and given Jews full civil rights. France was actually the first country in Europe to give Jews full civil rights. So that was the country that he devoted his life to defending. So I try to explain what that meant, this concept of Franco-Judaism, because it's true, it was a discreet kind of Judaism. In public, they, you know, were very similar to other French people, but they retained a lot of the characteristics of a distinct subgroup. So that was one thing of writing A Jewish Life. Another thing was focusing on the role of anti-Semitism in the case. And weirdly, that, you know, many historians try to downplay anti-Semitism. Not all, but, you know.
Yes, that does seem strange, though.
It does seem strange, I know. And nobody denies that it was an issue and that it was certainly an issue later in the Dreyfus affair. But there is a case to be made that he was, for instance, he was targeted because he was a modernizer, not primarily because he was a Jew. And I try to show in the book that, in fact, those two categories blend into each other. All the Jews were modernizers in the French army. But I also really focus on the way that anti-Semitism prepared the way for the case by the most famous anti-Semite in France was this guy, Edouard Drumont, and he had a daily anti-Semitic newspaper in the early 1890s. And one of his prime targets was the place of Jews in the army. He thought that all Jews were potential traitors to France. So he was publishing articles about this. It's not a surprise that then when they discover there is a traitor, they immediately blame the Jew. So that, to me, I don't think you can deny. It wasn't maybe the only factor that led them to suspect Dreyfus, but it was definitely a key one. And then the third aspect of my Jewish life of Dreyfus is, as I said, to look at the significance of the Dreyfus affair for the lives of Jews around the world.
In some senses, it was a mixed bag there, wasn't it? Because some communities didn't really want to become too engaged in the issue for fear of inciting further anti-Semitism.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because really all Jews were eventually obsessed by the affair. But it's true that at the beginning, right when he was accused, French Jews felt like he, you know, they were horrified by this, but had no reason to suspect that the army would have constructed a whole case against him if he were really innocent. So they kind of, you know, said, oh, well, you know, this is really terrible, but I guess we should accept it. It was then a couple years later, the information showing that he was really innocent and that another guy was the actual guilty party, this guy Esterhazy, and that the army was protecting Esterhazy, the real traitor, and keeping Dreyfus in prison. And I showed that then the French Jews first, followed by Jews around the world, became passionately devoted to getting justice for Dreyfus.
And indeed, his first conviction was overturned, but that was then followed, heartbreakingly, by a second conviction. Could you just describe the ultimate outcome for Alfred Dreyfus and I suppose what it meant for his life after he was finally restored to a position of honor within the French army?
Yeah, so, you know, eventually his family, his devoted wife and brother bring evidence to light that he was very clearly innocent. So the army is forced to overturn that first verdict, bring him back in the summer of 1899. He stands trial again for another court-martial at Rennes, and this time it's a media circus. It goes on for several months. But even though there's so little evidence to convict him, they still find him guilty again. The army just can't admit that it had made a mistake. But at this point, the whole world is watching, and the French government realizes that it's a PR disaster for them. And they were planning to host the World's Fair in 1900. So it's a little like the French hosting the Olympics this summer. And they were worried about a boycott. So they thought that other countries were just so horrified at the anti-Semitism in France and the outcome of the case that they realized they needed to do something. So the French government decides to offer him a pardon. And at first, his supporters don't want him to take it. He doesn't want to take it, but he can't face going back to Devil's Island. So he's persuaded to accept the pardon on the condition he can still fight to clear his name. So that's what happens. He rejoins his family. And then, you know, they have to basically uncover new evidence in order to reopen the case. So I'm condensing a lot here. It takes them a while. It takes them about 6 years. But they do eventually find other proof that the trials against him had been based on faulty evidence. So at that point, there's a civil trial, and he's declared fully innocent. He's totally exonerated. He's reintegrated into the army and offered the Legion of Honor. Although the slightly bad part of it is that they don't give him the rank that he should have had based on his years in the army. So they basically don't count the 5 years that he was in Devil's Island. So everyone who like came into the army with him was now at a higher rank. He protests and they say, sorry, there's nothing we can do. And at that point, he discreetly, in a very dignified way, resigns from the army and kind of lives a quiet life in retirement. But then when World War I happens, he rejoins the army and he serves again during World War I. He's an older man at this point. His son is grown and in fact fights in all the major battles in World War I. And then Dreyfus eventually dies in 1935.
It is an utterly compelling story and a very dramatic and persuasive account that you've given it. Thank you so much for speaking with us, Maurice Samuels.
Oh, thank you. It was really a pleasure.
Professor Maurice Samuels is director of Yale's Program for the Study of Antisemitism, and his new book is Alfred Dreyfus, The Man at the Center of the Affair.
ABCRN helps you understand the world. Find more of our stories on the ABC Listen app.